Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Hard Kill by Alan Manning and Brian Manning. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Chapter 1. Great Falls, Montana. Day 1. 12:33, Mountain Time. Welcome to the jungle. Guns and Roses. Emily meant everything to him. She was his daughter, his whole world, and he would do anything to protect her. Frank Colt struggled to adjust to a normal life since he retired from the army. Frank and Emily's mother, Jennifer, divorced not too long ago. The marriage didn't survive, but he and Jennifer wanted to make sure he would still be a part of their daughter's life. Frank and Emily planned to spend a week together during her summer break. Since she was six, she had an independent streak, insistent on having to do things herself, like learning to tie her shoes or ride a bike. Now 12 years old, Frank was relieved to know that her independence didn't yet exclude wanting to spend time with her father. Some days he felt that relating to his daughter was a struggle, but the past 2 days had been wonderful, and he hoped the rest of the week would go as well.
"Baby, lunch is ready," Frank said.
"Dad,"
Emily started. It wasn't Daddy anymore, Frank noted.
"I'm not a baby. I'm 12.
Frank smiled, not wanting to tell her that he'll always see her as his baby, and put the plates on the table. They ate in a cozy kitchen in a small, comfortable house. The inside was warm and inviting, with bright colors and ample lighting from the windows. Not exactly what someone would expect when coming to Frank's home. He allowed Jennifer to decorate it after the divorce. She wouldn't allow him to merely exist in a drab house that contained the barest amount of functional furniture. He sat next to Emily, sharing a casual meal with his daughter. Frank was content. He looked at her, smiling, but something outside caught his eye. A shadow moved across the window. For a moment, Frank questioned if he saw something.
"Please, God, not now," he thought, a flash of concern across his face.
"What's wrong?"
Emily asked.
He put a smile on his face and said, "Nothing. Everything's good."
His flashbacks and feelings of paranoia put stress on his marriage. Frank didn't cope too well, using anger as a defense, and withdrawing from his family. He eventually sought help after the divorce and was handling everything much better. He wanted things to be perfect with Emily, but he worried about the negative behaviors returning.
"It was nothing. You saw nothing," Frank told himself.
He needed this week to work out. For her. He stole a chip from her plate, and she swatted at his hand, laughing. He laughed, but in his mind alarm bells were ringing. Something felt wrong. He heard a sound outside, very faint, like a boot scuffing the dirt. But he didn't hear it, did he? There was no sound. It wasn't at the kitchen door leading to his backyard. There wouldn't be someone out there trying to come in and hurt them. Why would there be? Emily's face was a mirror of the unease he felt and showed. Frank was a statue, his eyes unfocused. She reached for his arm, trying to comfort him, but he moved away. He slid out of his chair with the ease of a shadow and stepped to the counter, pulling a large chef's knife from the wooden block. She was afraid for her father now.
"Dad, are you—"
Two sudden booms sounded, near simultaneously, as two of the three door hinges exploded. The door smashed inward, and the frame splintered under the boot, kicking the entryway open. A man in unmarked olive drab fatigues had moved through the entryway before the door fell to the ground, swinging a rifle, an M4 carbine, toward Emily. The barrel seemed to grow as she watched it point in her direction. The man never saw Frank, who stepped over the fallen door the moment it hit the floor. He grabbed the rifle by the barrel, lifting it into the air as he plunged the chef's knife deep into the man's stomach. The intruder screamed in shock and pain. Frank shouted to his daughter, "Run!" Another man, just outside the door, lifted the shotgun he used to blow the door hinges. Frank pulled the barrel of the M4 to one side, spinning the first man around to face the shotgun-wielding intruder. He wrapped one arm around the man's neck and grabbed the grip of the carbine. His human shield didn't put up a fight, more concerned with the knife Frank left plunged into his belly. Frank thumbed the selector of the rifle to fully automatic and fired one-handed, ripping a burst into the shotgunner outside. The deafening boom rattled the windows, as the second intruder fell back into the dirt and crawled out of the line of fire. Emily fled toward the living room when she heard the front door smashing open. Another man in the same drab fatigues moved through the doorway. Emily froze in fear,
but the burst fire from the kitchen caused the man in the living room to hesitate for a moment and jolted her back into action. Frank had to get his daughter to safety. He wrenched his human shield's head to one side, snapping the man's neck. He didn't have time to unsling the rifle, so he tossed the dead man aside before rushing to his daughter. Emily moved down the hall, and Frank crossed to the living room to follow. Shots rang out from the front door, and rounds crashed into the walls around him. One bullet punched into his thigh, almost knocking him over. Another hit him in the ribs and grazed across his back. Frank's vision tunneled into blackness for an instant before returning. He caught up to Emily and used his massive bulk to shield her as they ran toward the garage door. He glanced down at his thigh, and even though the pain was excruciating, he saw no blood, not even a hole in his jeans. They were using rubber bullets. They wanted him alive. Why? He opened the door into the garage and led his daughter to the black Ford F-350 parked inside. She opened the passenger door and jumped into the truck. Frank went to his tool shelves and opened a hidden compartment in the wall. He pulled out a Beretta M9 and two spare magazines. Pressing the slide of the weapon back slightly, Frank visually confirmed that there was a round in the chamber. He tucked the magazines into one of his back pockets and hopped into the driver's side.
"Buckle up, baby. Keep your head down," he said.
Emily was scared, tears welling up in her eyes. He tried his best to calm her with a smile. Frank usually kept the key inside the truck for emergency escape purposes. The irony that it was a behavior he did to ease his feelings of paranoia was not lost on him. He pressed the start button, and the powerful V8 diesel engine growled to life. The doorway connecting the house to the garage burst open as one man snapped his rifle up and began firing. Frank slammed the gear into reverse and stepped on the gas. Rubber riot rounds were slamming into the windshield, causing spiderweb cracks, as the F-350's wheels spun in place for a moment. They finally gained traction, and 3 tons of steel and rubber shot backward through the closed garage exterior door. The thin steel door gave only the slightest protest before it tore free from its rails and rolled under the heavy-duty tires. Looking back over his shoulder, Frank saw a van at the bottom of his driveway. It was parked sideways as a roadblock to discourage any attempted escape from the garage. The men in the van were not expecting this situation at all. Frank pressed the accelerator down as the pickup truck roared. The van driver's eyes shot wide, and he began grabbing and pushing random things on the dashboard, completely forgetting how to drive at that moment. Frank swerved the rear of the truck to one side the instant it slammed into the side of the van, nearly tipping it over. His driver's side window now faced the house, and he saw 2 more men outside his front door. They lifted their rifles to take aim. Frank put the Ford's gear into drive and reached out with the M9 pistol in his left hand. He emptied a full magazine of 9mm hollow points at the two as he drove away, hitting one of them in the chest before he could fire at the truck. Pulling away from the area, Frank glanced into the rearview mirror. He saw a car that was parked across the street from the house speed after him. The van was circling to follow them as the remaining armed men rushed to get inside it. Frank lived in a remote area, so he knew the police response time would be much longer than they could afford to wait. Still, he told Emily to call 911 and let them know what was happening. Frank switched the pistol to his right hand and reached into his back pocket with his left for one of the spare magazines. His right forearm was keeping the steering wheel stable as he thumbed a release that dropped the empty magazine free. He reloaded the M9 and stored it in a holster between his seat and the center console. The road ahead came to a sharp right turn, and Frank prepared to take the corner without slowing down. Emily had her cell phone out of her pocket, ready to dial emergency services when she caught the glint from something stretched across the road. She yelled for her father to slow down. Frank saw the spike strip right as his daughter shouted a warning. He swerved the truck back to the left to widen his turn and evade the spikes. The Ford slid off the left side of the road onto the narrow shoulder, and he fought to keep it away from the steep downhill drop into the wooded area. The truck's wheelbase was just too broad, and one of the rear double tires rolled over the spikes and burst. The four-wheel drive monster slid off the shoulder of the road and nearly tipped over. Frank corrected the wheel, steering off the road to keep them from flipping, but the left front end crashed into a tree. The impact caused the big Ford to spin counterclockwise, and the airbags exploded open. A moment later, the rear tire struck something solid during the fishtail spin. Frank and Emily were jerked violently to the right and suddenly felt weightless, as the momentum caused the truck to begin tumbling sideways down the hill. Windows shattered, throwing pebbles of safety glass everywhere. The remains of the black F-350 rocked to a stop deeper into the wooded area. Frank was dazed, but his body already sprang into action, unlatching his seatbelt. The vehicle's driver's side rested on the ground, and Emily dangled from her seatbelt down toward Frank. She was awake, but clutched her right arm with a pained expression.
Are you okay, sweetheart?
Frank asked.
I think my wrist is broken, she said.
A shake in her voice and tears in her eyes told Frank that she was trying to be brave for her father.
We have to keep moving, he said.
Frank released Emily's seatbelt while he cradled her in his arms. He let her down gently, pulled the Beretta from its holster, and tucked it into his pants. Reaching under the driver's seat, he unfastened an old Mossberg 500 pump-action shotgun that he kept there. It was his father's gun, and it was older than Frank. He kept the 12-gauge shotgun for more than sentimental reasons. The barrel was shortened for portability, and he knew that when he pulled the trigger, the old pump gun would not disappoint him. He racked the slide, loading a double-aught buckshot shell into the chamber.
"Can you run?"
Frank asked. She clutched her wrist to her chest and gave a small nod.
"You're so brave, and Daddy's very proud of you. I'll get you out of here," he said, kissing her forehead.
Frank stepped out through the shattered remains of the front windshield and visually scanned the area. The car and the van were getting closer, but he saw a man moving across the street with a rifle aimed toward his truck.
"That must be the one who set up the spikes," Frank thought.
The man saw Frank and snapped a quick shot, hitting the truck inches from his face. Frank stepped away from the pickup in a flash, firing his shotgun one-handed while his other arm guided Emily safely behind him. The Mossberg roared, and 9 .32-caliber pellets smashed through the rifleman's chest and neck, throwing him to the ground. The smell of gasoline became apparent in the air, mixed with traces of smoke. Frank turned and scooped Emily into his arms, sprinting deeper into the woods.
"I have to get her away before—"
The deafening explosion of his truck was sudden, and the blast carried him off his feet. Frank used his large body to shield his daughter from the heat and shrapnel. He hit the ground hard and rolled with the impact to keep Emily from getting injured anymore. Pieces of burning debris showered down nearby as he lifted his girl to her feet.
"Run,"
he told her, dragging himself back up. A car pulled just off the side of the road, keeping its distance from the burning wreck. Two men exited the rear of the vehicle and covered the truck with their M4 carbines. One of them caught the movement in the woods and spotted Frank and Emily trying to get away. "Target in the woods," the man called out, pointing in Frank's direction. The van then arrived and bounded carelessly down the grassy slope, stopping just beyond the destroyed F-350. The three remaining men from the assault team poured out of the back, moving through the woods at a near run. Frank heard their pursuers closing in. Emily tried to run as fast as she could, but every jarring step caused agony in her wrist. Tears streamed down her face as she moved. He had to slow the men down.
"Keep going,"
Frank yelled. He spun around and took cover behind a tree. Three men moved in his direction. He racked in a fresh 12-gauge shell, brought the shotgun up, and fired. At 30 yards, the buckshot spread, but the hit was still enough to stop one of the pursuers. The other two men crouched and took cover. They tried leaning out to shoot, but Frank kept them suppressed, firing three more blasts, working the pump action smoothly between shots. He turned and ran back toward his daughter. The air cracked and whizzed around him as the rifle sent more riot rounds in his direction. Pain exploded across his right arm, causing him to drop the Mossberg. Frank stumbled as he ran, the momentum carrying him forward. He rolled over his shoulder and came up to a knee, facing the men with rifles. He pulled the Beretta from his waist, put the front sight of the M9 on one of the soldiers, and pressed the trigger twice. At the same moment, the man returned fire with his M4. Frank's first 9mm round drilled through the man's sternum, where he put the front sight. A rubber bullet blasted him high in the chest, near his left shoulder, causing Frank's second shot to miss. The pain overloaded his senses. Frank had to fight to remain conscious. He sat back on the ground, firing the Beretta one-handed. The slide locked back when the gun was empty, and he reached back for his last magazine when something hissed through the air and snapped his head backward. The bright flash of pain in his head turned to a dull ache, and everything turned to blur and blackness. A man in a gaudy, shiny fabric shirt stepped out of the passenger side of the dark sedan parked near the burning truck. The button-up shirt was a fiery red that sparkled like flames in the sunlight. Only the lower three buttons were closed, allowing the shirt to flow open and show the white tank top and brown leather shoulder holster under it. He rolled up the sleeves to his elbows while he walked into the woods, listening to the sound of someone screaming. Two men pulled a young girl toward the van. She fought with them while shouting and crying. Carl Lawler looked back as they walked past, but his white leather shoes never broke their stride toward the injured man lying on the ground. The man on the ground called out to the girl. He turned his attention to Carl and his men, yelling curses and threats between his labored breaths. Carl stopped in front of the man and looked down at him with amusement. Frank Colt was this man's name,
He is highly skilled and will be dangerous, the report read. Carl was impressed at how skilled Frank Colt proved to be, but ultimately, he was confident they would accomplish the mission.
Please, Frank was pleading now. Just let her go. Let her go, and I'll do what you want.
Carl's smile grew as he took his mirror-lens aviator sunglasses off and slid them into his shirt pocket. He reached a hand into his open shirt and came out with a chrome-plated Desert Eagle, chambered in .44 Magnum. He pointed the muzzle of the monstrous handgun at Frank.
My friend, Carl said, we don't want you at all.
Frank looked at his daughter and suddenly realized she was the one they were after. The riot rounds were used to make sure she would be taken alive. Carl pulled the heavy trigger and shot Frank in the chest. He flattened back to the ground and gurgled out a final breath. His eyes stayed open. A scream sounded from the van, the girl understanding the meaning of the gunshot. Carl kept the Desert Eagle aimed at Frank's body. Confirm that Frank Colt is deceased, the report also said. He fired 7 more times into the body until the gun ran empty. The smile never left Carl's face. He put the pistol back into his shoulder holster, reached into his pocket, and retrieved his sunglasses. Before he left, Carl saw a drop of red on one of his white shoes. He swiped his foot on the dead man's pants to wipe away the blood. Carl twirled one finger in the air as a signal for everyone to move out and walked casually back to his car. The men loaded their fallen into the van, and the two vehicles sped away.
Chapter 2 Day 1 1504 Mountain Time
The phone was ringing when Jennifer came in from her garage. Her daughter, Emily, usually called later in the evening to tell her how her day was. The call was a little earlier than she expected. Maybe it's just a solicitor, she thought, but hurried just in case. She ran to the phone, high heels clicking on the tile floor, trying to pick up before the answering machine did.
Hello?
Jennifer answered with an expectant smile, reaching down to take off her shoes.
Is this Jennifer Dawson? The voice was polite but felt emotionless.
Yes.
The smile gave way to confusion.
Who is the...
Formerly married to Frank Colt? The voice cut her off.
Who is this?
Jennifer demanded, fighting the small but growing dread in her stomach.
Jennifer Dawson, the smooth voice continued as if she never asked a question. We have your daughter, Emily, age 12. Frank Colt is dead.
The shoe fell from her hand. Her heart dropped from her chest. Jennifer choked back a gasping cry, covering her mouth with one hand, the other trembling and pressing the phone firmly against her ear for fear of it falling to the floor. The voice continued.
If you do exactly what we say, when we say, you will see Emily return to you, safe and unharmed.
Jennifer felt so small and helpless. She kept her hand over her mouth, afraid to make a noise and miss any details.
Miss Dawson, we know you work for Intellisys, as a senior project manager in the research and development department. We know that your team developed a new type of decryption software.
How do you know that? Jennifer blurted out, immediately regretting it.
Don't interrupt, Miss Dawson, the voice said, as calm as a teacher chiding a student. We know that your team developed a portable device that can use the new software. What we want, Jennifer, is for you to go to work tomorrow morning, just like any typical day. Once inside, you will retrieve the prototype device and take it out of the building. After that, we will contact you with further instructions.
Jennifer stood with her knees locked just to stay upright. The hand on her mouth now grasped the counter for stability. This was a nightmare.
Allow me to make the situation very clear, for the benefit of you and your daughter. The emotionless voice continued. Under no circumstances are you to call anyone for help. Do not involve the police or any government agencies. Your daughter's life depends on it.
Someone outside the company found out about the existence of the device. In a company as large as Intellisys, the leak could come from anywhere.
What do I do now? She thought.
The voice on the phone was very specific. No police, no one else, or they would kill Emily.
She had to go into work tomorrow, gain access to a technology that was kept locked and guarded, and bring it to people she never met. If they honored their word, they would give her Emily in exchange for the device. Except there was no reason they would have to keep either of them alive. Nothing would stop them from taking the device from her and killing them both. The voice continued to give her very specific conditions for what they expected of her. Jennifer listened helplessly, hopelessly, as tears streamed freely down her face.
Chapter 3. Day 1, 1915 Mountain Time. Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen. Early Thursday evening at the Foxhole Bar was more lively than usual on a weekday. It was near the end of happy hour, and many of the customers started their Friday nights a day early. The inside felt friendly and inviting, without the family-themed franchise atmosphere. The bartender changed the program on the flat screen behind the bar from the local news to the sports channel. John Stone was a part owner of the Foxhole, but he enjoyed working an occasional shift as it allowed him to see how the business was doing. Also, he liked getting to know the locals that came for a drink or meal. Tonight, about a dozen people currently patronized the bar. John knew most of them, but two men he didn't know were near the back of the bar, beginning to raise their voices and get aggressive. One man was at a table, now standing up. He was nearly 6 feet tall, with the strong hands and arms of a working man. He was yelling something to another man at the bar. The man at the bar drank his beer and raised his voice to shoot angry responses back over his shoulder. This man was not as tall as the first, but made up for the height by carrying more weight. His thick muscles were surrounded in places by a generous layer of fat. His bald head, shaved clean by choice, betrayed a receding hairline visible in the stubble. The talk had grown louder over the course of the past minute. Now both men stood and closed the distance to each other. John made his way out from behind the bar and positioned himself between them. He placed a hand on each of their shoulders and kept them apart. His hands and arms were also well-muscled, ending in the equally weathered and worn hands of a blue-collar grinder. John's barrel-chested build was developed while fighting for the freedom and security of his countrymen, as an Army Ranger. Unlike many of the men he served with, who had allowed themselves to settle into the post-military life, letting their hardened bodies smooth over with age and dormancy, John maintained his strength and fitness. He stood over the two men, outmatching them both in height and physique. John turned his head to face each one as he spoke.
"Gentlemen, I'm not sure what this is about, but perhaps it's something that you can settle in a calmer fashion."
John's tone was even, yet it carried authority. His voice matched his close-cropped brown flat top, piercing eyes, and rugged appearance. His facial expression let them know that he wasn't asking. A thick mustache that covered his top lip separated his chiseled granite jawline and cheekbones, ending just at the corners of his mouth. His head sat atop a powerful neck that started at his ears and splayed out like a pyramid.
"You're right, man,"
the shorter, thicker man said, putting his hands up and leaning back just enough to separate John's hand from his shoulder.
"We just let things get a bit heated. I'm sorry."
The corners of John's mouth pulled up in what passed for a smile, and his eyes softened as he nodded his acceptance. The taller man swatted John's arm away.
"Get your hand off me, old man. Think you can just blimp over here and tell us what to do?"
He turned to face John, now focusing his ire on the old warrior. John knew it was the alcohol talking, the super soldier serum in a bottle that made this young man think he was invincible. He found himself cutting to the faux bravado with his words on an almost weekly basis, but this time it felt as if this kid was spoiling for a fight.
"Hey, listen, fights tend to cost me money and customers when they happen."
He took a step forward but kept his voice calm.
"And when I lose money and customers, it upsets me. So I can't let that happen. Are we clear?"
John dipped his head to lock eyes with the brash drunk, letting him know that he only expected one answer.
"Hey, man, it's cool,"
the young man said with a smile that was far less genuine than he thought. He let his hands drop to his sides as his shoulders sagged. For most people, this would seem to be a natural gesture of acceptance. But John could read the intention behind the posture. Interpreting an enemy's body language was an ability that he developed in battle, and it kept him alive in all his years of service. The stakes tonight were much lower, but his instinct didn't have an off switch. Just as he expected, the rowdy drunk jerked back and telegraphed a sucker punch. John tucked his chin, leading with his forehead, and stepped inside the wild arc of the swing, Instead of the billiard ball clack of a head-to-head collision, there was a dull thunk as John's perfectly timed counter headbutt smashed into the bridge of his attacker's nose, using his momentum against him. Blood splattered from the man's nostrils, painting spotty crimson cones on his shirt as he rocked back. The man staggered on his heels before dropping to the ground on his tailbone. After two slight swaying rotations, he fell back. Laughing and cheering erupted in the bar. It was rare that John had to dirty his hands to take care of a troublemaker, but when it happened, the regulars knew they were in for a show. And tonight, they were not disappointed. A few of the cheering patrons passed over small bills, losing their bets on how fast John would clean up the mess. John knelt down and grabbed a handful of the unconscious man's pant leg and dragged him to the front door. Then he put a massive hand under each of the man's armpits and hoisted him up, shouldering him like a sack of flour. John walked to the bus stop near the front of his bar and deposited the man in the normal trash pickup spot for troublemakers in his bar. He turned, wiping his hands together, and then along the fronts of his thighs when he noticed a man leaning near the entrance of the bar. He wore his tie loose in the after-hours fashion, dangling from his open collar. His suit looked like it fit him 5 years and 15 pounds ago, but now tugged at his midsection. John recognized him, not by his outfit, but the hardened eyes of a man who served.
"Mark? Is that you?"
"Yeah, John. It's been a long time."
John couldn't help but notice that even though Mark Brenner smiled, he looked exhausted, like the day had just ground him down into an ashtray. They exchanged a big handshake as John clapped a hand on the man's shoulder. He could still feel the muscles of his arm, underneath the layer of insulation a desk job seemed to install into even the hardiest of men.
"What's with the silk noose?" John asked. "And the extra padding?"
"Some of us weren't lucky enough to get into the sanitation field after we served," Mark said, glancing over at the unconscious man at the bus stop. "I took a job with the company, behind a desk."
"The CIA?"
John heard rumors that Mark ended up working with the spooks, but it was somehow strange having it confirmed. John's smile beamed, but the luster faded as he noticed that it wasn't exhaustion that he saw in the man's face.
"What's wrong, Mark?"
"It's Frank," Mark said with a sigh. "He was murdered."
John felt a hammer blow hit him in his heart. He put a hand over his eyes, pressing his temples with his fingers and thumb. He took two deep breaths to calm down.
"What about Jennifer and Emily?" John asked.
Frank shared custody of his daughter, Emily, with his ex-wife.
"Jennifer's okay. She was at work when this happened." "Where's Emily? Where is my goddaughter?"
"John, they took her."
"Who? What do you mean, they?"
John's fists tightened. Typically never one to lose his temper, he struggled to contain his fury. Mark saw John was having trouble coping with the bombshell he just dropped on his friend.
"I've got a file here, with everything we currently know."
He handed a bound envelope, thick with papers and folders stuffed inside.
"Let's go back to your office."
John's office was small, but he kept it clean. All of the paperwork was stored and filed with care. His military discipline didn't allow him to let his workspace fall into disarray and make his job more difficult. He sat at the desk and opened the envelope Mark gave him.
"I'm not going to waste my breath telling you that I'm not supposed to disclose any of this to you," the CIA pencil pusher said. "I know you would eventually get your hands on it anyway, and I wanted you to know everything."
"You still haven't answered my question, Mark. Who did this?"
"We don't have that information yet, but I can tell you that Emily appeared to be the target."
John straightened up when he heard that.
"How do you know that? Why would they want Emily?"
Mark rifled through the stacks of papers on John's desk, pulling one out and handing it to him.
"This is the forensic account of the crime scene. The attackers used rubber bullets, and the autopsy reports show bruising consistent with the findings."
"And they didn't want to risk killing Emily," John said, finishing Mark's explanation.
"Yes," Mark said. "Once they had her, Frank was shot at point-blank range. Multiple gunshot wounds from a .44 caliber handgun."
"Is this about Jennifer?" John asked.
He knew Frank's ex-wife worked in the tech industry, and Emily could possibly be used as leverage to get something from Jennifer.
"We believe so," Mark said. "Her position at a major data security company points in that direction. And we also know that her relationship with Frank was still amicable after the divorce, so there is no reason to think that she is a suspect."
What did she say?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?